Greetings. Is this Paula?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Hello.
I think it's James.
I think we're all here.
Okay.
Yes, I'm David.
And
hi, Paula.
James, and I think I hear Paula.
Okay. Alrighty.
Okay. If Ammon, I think Ammon's going to get started. He can edit this up. But I want to make sure before we get started that I have the right introduction information for you, David. Now,
mm-hmm.
You're the associate curator?
Yes. I'm an associate curator. We have many here.
Okay, that's what I meant to say. And you're in the Division of Work and Industry.
That's right, at the National Museum of
American
History.
Okay. And I think what we'll do is go ahead and get started. Typically, I think I'll ask a question, and I have some notes here, and I will direct the question to one of you in particular, but please feel free for the other to jump in and add to it. Hopefully each question will have a chance for both of you to speak. And I'll start timing, and we'll end it at an hour, and we'll follow up in the future with a second session. Does that sound okay to everybody?
And do you edit this down before
it will
it's
be
podcast?
Edited. Yes.
I'm sorry?
Yes.
What did you say?
Yes, it is. It will be edited.
Okay.
I think there isn't much internal editing. I think that, they edit for a clean start and a clean finish, but the content is not edited much, unless there's a problem of some kind.
Right.
Okay. Are you ready, Paula?
I'm ready.
Okay. let me get started here. Good afternoon. I'm James Hallebuck from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. And I'd like to welcome you to today's Object of History Forum. The Object of History is a joint project between the Center for History and New Media and the Smithsonian National Museum of American History to provide students and teachers around the country with a look at key objects from the collection. Our focus today is the gold nugget found in California in 1848. We'll be talking about that nugget on the specifics, on its impact on American culture and American history. We're joined today by two guests, Paula Petrick, who's professor of history at George Mason University. Among other things, she works on the history of the American West. And David Shait, an associate curator from the National Museum of American History in the Division of Work and Industry. Hi, David, and hi, Paula.
Hi.
Hello.
I think we'll get started right away. The first question that we have is from Eileen from New York. Paula, she asks, were there other places in the world where gold can be found? And what was it about the discovery of gold in California that caused such keen interest?
I think there's a number of questions all rolled into that one. Let's take the first one in terms of are there other places where gold can be found? I think it's present tense, but I'm assuming that means at the same time or thereabouts that the California gold rush occurred. Is that correct?
That's right.
Okay. Yes. But for our purposes, the California gold discovery was the first in a string of very lucrative gold discoveries in the United States. It was followed up 10 years later by the discovery of gold in Colorado, then followed up by the discovery of gold in Montana and to a lesser extent Idaho, and finally in South Dakota. And all of these gold strikes became, in terms of gold mining, these strikes sort of hit the ball out of the park. For example, the Last Chance Gulch strike in Helena, Montana was the fourth richest Homestake mine. I believe it was the second richest. So there were a good many other places. Now, this doesn't even take into account international gold exploration, for example, in South Africa, in Russia, and in some of the Asian countries, specifically India, although India was probably better known for its silver. So no. So yes, this was a huge international kind of exploratory program. I think second only to the discovery, and well, I would say the discovery about the exploitation of gold in South America.
In terms of why California's gold rush became so widespread and internationally famous, Paula, don't you think that has a lot to do with the media at the time and the fact that it was methodically promoted, not just
yes.
discovered?
Yes, I think that's entirely true. We had the printing presses rolling at full speed, people writing handbooks, people writing letters home. So there's a huge sort of publicity, of course, surrounding it. Newspaper articles, people writing home to hometown newspapers, talking about the elephant and what they'd seen when they had finally seen the elephant. It's a fellow who's written a wonderful book called The World Rushed In, J.S. Halliday, and he really provides a sense of that, the writing home, the word of mouth, the publications that engendered the whole migration to California. And
right. In fact, it's not commonly understood that gold was known to exist in California before the gold rush was launched. The Indian communities knew that there was gold. They made things out of the gold there. The Mexicans who occupied the land before us certainly found gold here and there. But it was the methodical exploitation of the public fascination with gold by Americans, or what we call today Americans, that then produced this fever that resulted in the incredible discovery of vast riches of gold.
I think also there was the fact that there was a lot of gold.
Yes.
At Sutter's Mill, there were huge bars where the geological processes had washed this gold into banks. And so literally, as the water erosion, as the miners, even with their pans, sort of went through these bars, as they were called, they could, you know, find a lot of gold in a very short time. Those, of course, who were lucky and
yes,
first on the spot. That we have to remember that.
Okay, so we have sort of a perfect storm of the amount of gold that's out there and the ease with which people are able to gather it, along with the publicity.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
well, thank you, Eileen, for that question. I guess we shouldn't take for granted that we know how this works exactly. David, could you tell us, this question is from Sean in California, could you tell us how the first miners mined for gold? What were the techniques that they used, and did they evolve?
Oh, they definitely evolved. It's a wonderful story of American innovation and ingenuity and just plain hard work. The earliest gold was found the way our nugget was found, by somebody stooping down and picking it up out of a flowing river. James Marshall found what we call our first fine gold nugget by watching it glitter in the tail race. His writings on the subject indicate that he stooped down and picked it up and found some more and held them up to the light, bit them, hammered them between rocks as a test for gold, and then, of course, with some chemicals back at Sutter's Mill, found that, in fact, it was gold. Early mining techniques varied from that, just stooping down and picking it up, to more methodical uses of pans and shovels, and gradually working their way up to sluice boxes and long johnnies, and eventually very elaborate industrial techniques using hydraulic pressure and mines, deep hard rock mines, to win the gold from the earth itself. But typically the earliest gold was there to be grabbed right through the waters, don't you think, Paula? The writings indicate people madly rushing up into the creeks of Northern California, putting gold in their pockets and having quite an experience.
Yes, and then of course the need after that, after the easy gold was all gone,
mm-hmm,
was to move on up to a more systematic, deeper penetration of these bars and the banks on these rivers, hoping to recover the gold that had become embedded further back. And you have the developing then of a technique called hydraulicking, where high-pressure hoses were turned on these banks to loosen the gravel and then into the sluice boxes once again. Problem with hydraulicking, of course, and subsequent kinds of gold recovery is that it really ruined a lot of streams. We can see this today in some of the places where hydraulicking was used, and this, of course, was followed up by dredging late in the 19th and early 20th centuries.
The methods of mining absolutely produced other economies. People began mining the economy of the miners, you might say. Levi Strauss, that we all know about through Levi Jeans, got his start by making pants for miners out of sailcloth. And so there are so many layers to this story beyond just the extraction of gold.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, those who mined the miners made the most money.
Yes, and stayed the longest.
Yes.
But these techniques grow increasingly invasive and destructive, don't they?
Incredibly so. Vast tracts of forest were destroyed because of the ground they sat on. Miners were a feverish sort of people. They didn't have a whole lot of respect for nature the way we do today. We try to anyway. And there was this wholesale raping of the landscape in Northern California, much to the dismay of local residents and folks who appreciated the natural environment the way it was. Mining and gold had their own sort of insanity about them. There are cases where people, of course, fight for claims, but then end up mining land that has already been mined, sifting through the tailings and the finished work left by other methods of mining.
Okay.
I think one thing to remember about this this exploitation of the landscape is there was always this search for the mother lode, because as everyone knew at the time, the gold found in streams and whatnot was the gold had been eroded off a much larger vein and carried downstream. So there's this effort to find that solid vein of gold that would, of course, yield riches. The problem with that, of course, is that geology is capricious, and the mother lode is difficult to find. For example, in several places, the mother lode will probably never be found.
We do have in the Smithsonian collections large leaves of mother-like gold that has been found deep underground by industrial mining methods, with large companies finding it, just giving one indication of what that mother lode may have looked like in its original state.
Mm-hmm. Those are very beautiful, the wire gold.
Yes.
I see. Well, moving on, Paula, Pearl from Oregon is interested in the relationship, or I should say the ratio, of women to men that come out to California during the gold rush. Were there more? We would assume that there were more men that come out to California, but we could also assume that that there were women that came as well. So what is the ratio there, and what sort of relationships are there between those men and those women?
Well, I think the first part of the question is one that's difficult to get at because it varied from community to community and over time. For example, initially in the very early stages of, say, placer mining, the sex ratio would be enormously skewed toward men, to 20, 25 to 1, huge differential between men and women. But women did come, and as time passed, more and more came. But to me, the interesting thing is what they did when they got there. And I think it didn't take women long to figure out that mining the miners in oh so many ways was a good way to make money. And one of the ways they did this was externalize their domestic work onto Main Street. So instead of doing laundry for free, they would charge to do laundry. Instead of cooking for free, they would open a restaurant and cook for the miners and make quite a handsome living because of the scarcity of the commodities that they could put together. And many men didn't know how to make biscuits. Certainly some did, but many did not. And so to have a good meal of biscuits and gravy, especially after you've had none, is something to be, which you'd pay top dollar for.
Right.
So clean clothes, good meals, and then, of course, there was the sex. But maybe we shouldn't go there.
Paula, do you want to tell this questioner what that expression means, having seen the elephant? That's an expression unique to the gold rush period.
Well, I think, like many things, it has a number of different origins, explanations. But to see the elephant was what the Argonauts called to see California. And to be honest, I'm not exactly sure what the origin of that. Perhaps David could help out with the elephant business.
Please, well, I think I'm intrigued by it because I've done a fair bit of work with elephant American elephant history and our relationship to elephants, especially African elephants. From the 1790s onward, we've had this love-hate relationship with these beasts, chiefly through their ivory. The ivory piano-keyed piano, the ivory-keyed piano, the billiard ball, combs, so many things we take for granted today were made out of good old elephant tusk ivory. Well, in the 1840s and 50s, the elephant was seen as a perhaps inexhaustible source of such resources. A huge animal full of this beautiful material, ivory, plentiful supplies of elephants, unquenchable numbers in Africa, and a very important resource in many ways. So to me, it sort of sums up the exoticism of California, this distant land, almost Africa-like, this enormous animal, this animal of California, full of this wondrous material, whether it's ivory or gold. To me, it's almost deliciously interchangeable, typically a material that isn't readily available except through great conquest and danger and discovery, very much like the story of the Argonauts. So that is my reference to seeing the elephant. It means you've been to California, you've been through all the discovery process and the privations and the dangers, almost equivalent to a trip to Africa.
Well, mystery solved, right, Paul?
Maybe.
Well, I had read about the origins, you know, lying in the elephant's exoticism, but David's interpretation with the ivory and the piano keys is, of course, much more interesting. And I think
I think
much better on a number of levels. So.
Well, I think we have a notion that lots and lots of people from the eastern part of the United States went west and struck it rich, made $1 million picking up gold and stuffing their pockets with gold. David, how successful was the average miner? Did lots of people make lots of money?
Oh, many people made much money, but frankly, the average miner did not do terribly well. Depending on who you talk to, of course, and which stories you believe, the ones that I've read the most of have to do with a fair bit of hidden shame of young men and husbands and brothers and fathers disappearing from their farms in Ohio and Kentucky, and in some difficult way explaining to their families years later that, in fact, they didn't make it rich. They were taken advantage of. They came too late. Keep in mind, the rush didn't last forever. It was the premier gold rush, the golden gold rush, was over in just a few years. But by then, a word had just begun reaching some of the outlying states, and there were many late arrivals, men, sometimes with their families, sometimes women, would come out seeking these riches, California streets paved with gold, only to come up empty or come up short. And even sadder are the stories of miners who did hit it rich, but then lost it all on gambling or loose women or businesses that went awry, and they just ended up desperate for getting home, finding money to borrow to get back home. But I think even if you were to ask them if they had had it to do over again, would they have? And of course, they would have said yes. It's the lure of the gold, the rush of the rush, you might say, that spurred most of them on the prospect of seeing riches rather than their acquisition. And it's part of the romance of the gold rush era that it perhaps matters a little less how much money they made and were they a part of that gold rush.
I see. Paula, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think David has hit the nail on the head there. But I think there's another thing to remember, and that is that the gold rush was primarily a young man's game. And this is a period in their lives, or maybe even a young married man's game. We have some diaries where they sort of go off on this magnificent backpacking trip. And I think that for many young men, it was a place in their lives where they could do this. And that has to do with the life cycle that we look at in history. And like David, I think that if we were to ask them, even though they had suffered deprivation and had not found gold and become rich, that they wouldn't have traded it for the world.
All right. That certainly, we would do well to remember that there were fortunes made and fortunes lost.
We're not trying to encourage young people to go off and dig for gold now. Do you understand that? They were swept up in the movement.
and places where gold is readily available now are not places you want to go.
That's true.
All right. Well, let's talk about heroes then. I think we all have sort of an image of what a gold miner looks like. But were there heroes? Is this a story of heroes? Is there class conflict here? How would you say that the gold rush affects class relations?
Paul, you want to take that, Paula? That's
Give me the hard question about class.
Well, let me just start by saying that heroes are everywhere, and so are villains. It's a story of great villainy and heroism, and depending on how you define a hero could be somebody who supplies the right kind of machinery and tools for the miners to use to ease the hard labor, and thereby he becomes a heroic, successful businessman. But if you're talking about other kinds of heroes, I don't know. It depends on how we define the word, eh, Paula?
Well, yeah. I'm not quite comfortable thinking about heroes in the gold rush.
Right.
I think hero might be misplaced in terms of talking about the gold rush. I mean, certainly there were people who distinguished themselves. They had an opportunity to do great things, and they did, but that's symptomatic of any kind of endeavor. I think it's perhaps better to say who was able to capitalize on their gold rush experience and turn it into something greater. That might be a way of looking at the hero business. And I think there are those people that the gold rush and the gold rushes that follow the 49ers are all. Are all opportunities to do this. And so you see people, and primarily not the miners, but the people who follow the miners, able to carve out careers for themselves, able to really be on the ground floor of creating an economy. They're able to capitalize on the destabilization that the gold rush creates and the other runs after it. So I think that might be a way of looking at it. Of course, then again, you get the people who capitalize on it, and I think there's a Southern writer who created a person called Suggs, who said it's good to be shifty in a new country. And I think that in many ways prevailed in the American West and in California and other elephant territories.
For sure. Keep in mind that the Gold Rush gave birth to many other important movements, chiefly the establishment of the state of California, but also entire art movements were created. Many artists came out to paint the Gold Rush and to paint the miners at work and the landscapes that they were pillaging. The city of San Francisco owes much of its heroic origins to the Gold Rush and how it became an enormous boom town. So heroism is a very relative term. It has to be mixed in with all kinds of other human traits and aspirations of the time.
Point taken. What about the class angle there? Do we have a situation where class tensions or class structures are exported west, or do we have a new social order, or what's going on out west?
Oh, I hear the tiptoes of Frederick Jackson Turner. I would say there are a couple ways of looking at that, and here I pose a question, and that is that and we have to sort of take ourselves a little bit later into the 19th century, and that is this: that although the ideology of woman suffrage was anchored in the East, its political successes were in the West, and no one's ever adequately explained that. Because by rights, the political successes should have been in the East. Certainly the number of supporters were there. But there was something about the West, or places in the West, because no state was the same, that seemed more congenial to those aspirations. And I wanted to bounce off something that David said about the painters. There's a wonderful painting, and I can't remember who did it, but it's of a barroom scene. And in this barroom scene, there are enormous diversity of men in there. There's a Hispanic man wearing a poncho. There are several Asians, there are white people, and there is, you know, there are African Americans, and all these men are in the same barroom. And I think that's something to contemplate also, because there was some kind, and it's not to say that racism vanished as you crossed the Mississippi River, but something was going on there that allowed for a time those different kinds of people to rub shoulders in the same social space. So I have no answers to this, mind you, but I think that there's certain things that travel west, but it's more interesting to me is what happens to them once they arrive. How are they altered and transformed to become something else, something that perhaps works itself out as the passage of woman suffrage later on in the century? Boy, that
yes,
went far afield, didn't it?
Well, it happily, it all has this common theme of gold. To me, gold is a new common denominator that reorganizes people. At the time, there was this sense that perhaps there was enough gold for everybody, no matter what your prior class was or state in life. It was a welcoming notion that people from Ireland and from all kinds of places in Asia and Europe and Africa could come together and find their piece of heaven there in California, and sometimes even work together. The pictures and the paintings I've seen show a great commingling of all the races and clearly all the classes. Obviously, there was breakdown here and there, but as is today, California is this sense of new promise, a new land. I must confess I'm a native Californian, and coming back east is always this notion of coming back to old traditions versus the new ideas out where the sun sets on the Pacific coast. And you can start anew. You can make life over again, whether as an individual or perhaps part of a world community. Good question.
I think that idea of making your life over again was an important one, too, that one could be someone else, mm-hmm. Be something else as you cross. I think the diaries are replete with that, and people's reminiscences as they look back on their time in the West in various gold fevers, that the idea that one could become something different. Now, that's not to say that everyone did. I mean, some people certainly were, if they were good, they stayed good, and if they were bad, they just, continued
yes,
on their merry
yes.
way.
That's right. And again, even if gold mining ends in misery and sorrow, these are memorable times. As we heard from the World War II, these are, in many cases, the best years of our lives because of what we were up to, and we were breaking free of the old ways.
All right. I want to thank Andrew from Michigan for that question. And then on to the next one. Before we take this situation for granted, we should probably talk a little bit more about general ideas. How global was the gold rush? Do we have people coming from outside the United States of America?
That certainly might. Go ahead,
David. Sorry, David.
Well,
go ahead.
We can both have a try at this. That's certainly my impression, that it was truly a global gold rush, not only because of the situation of California in between worlds right there on the Pacific coast, almost a world away from the established East Coast, but because of the new means of communication and the new high-speed, by those terms, those days, high-speed transportation of sailing ships and the newly steam-powered vessels that could cross the Atlantic Ocean. It's my feeling that it was quite global. Obviously not to every land in every corner of the world, but for those who could afford it, however they would get there, through Panama or overland through across the United States or across the Pacific Ocean. It's a very much an international experience. Don't you think, Paula? Is there some truth to that?
Oh, yeah. I think the world rushed in, most certainly. I think one of the most interesting things, though, one thing that we tend to forget is the hemispheric migrations, that people came from South America to California. One of the more interesting accounts I've read that tied in so long ago with a woman I found ultimately in Montana was in the census I found her as being from Chile. I think, what is a person from Chile doing in Montana in 1880? How could she possibly have gotten there? And of course, I immediately thought that the census enumerator had made an error, as one of many that he did make. But I was reading along, and I discovered that at some point in Chile's history, that the government decided to throw out all the fancy ladies and put them on ships, mm-hmm. and they went north to San Francisco. And once they were in San Francisco, of course, they fanned out across the American West, apparently. But here, once again, is this idea that, and just, you know, it happened, this ejection of these women just happened to coincide with one of the gold rushes or gold discoveries. And I thought, well, and then I began to see more and more accounts of people coming from Latin America, from South America, and joining in both the California gold rush and the subsequent gold rushes, which I thought was, you know, I thought we just never think of that this was also a hemispheric phenomenon.
Yes, and not to forget the other gold rush. There, obviously, as we've heard, many gold rushes. There is the gold rush in California, but then the Klondike emerges in the at the end of the 19th century to create this almost echo of California, but in much colder circumstances, but producing a very different kind of global response of miners coming from Canada and the U.S., of course, and east and west.
I think there were some career miners, because I have found people who seem to have been in all the gold rushes.
My gosh,
starting
wow.
with California and going to Colorado and to Montana, and finally they end up, you know, knee-deep in snow on the Chilicoot Pass.
Wow.
As they make their way to the Klondike. So I think there were some careerists involved.
Yes, that's right. Oh, committed miners, my God.
The Peter Pans of the gold rush, who just never quite grew up.
And just imagine the stories they tell around those campfires of growing up in the gold fields. My God.
Oh. Well, curiously enough, we have a question from Rachel in South Carolina asking about the Chinese. Particularly, why were so many Chinese interested in the gold rush? I guess we could start with that question.
Do you want to start off with that one? And I can
tell you. We can speculate. It's certainly not an area of expertise for me, but certainly the Chinese are a major factor in the development of California generally, in business and industry and commerce, and in the rise of their own specific culture, chiefly in San Francisco, but spread throughout the state as well. The Asian populations were a factor in the gold rush. They were often servants or assistants to wealthy miners who could afford to hire workers. Why they came from China, it's a question of opportunity, as it always has been, but there was pretty overt discrimination against the Chinese in California during the gold rush and beyond. But the details of that are pretty well laid out in some important histories of Chinese immigration to California, the reasons behind it. We know them also as very energetic workers on the railroads of the West, competing with other groups. But Paula, any more specific reasons behind the immigration?
Well, I think several of the people who have written about the Chinese migrations have talked about the push-pull factor and the fact that they come from a particular region in China that had suffered tremendous famine and disaster. So there's a push pushing them out of China to find, you know, literally for some of them to find something to eat and a way to support their families. So they you know, set off for the Golden Mountain. And their idea was, of course, never to stay, and to go back and bring what they'd found with them. The other thing to think about, too, in the different sort of cultural approaches to work, is the fact that the Chinese worked in gangs. You very seldom had the individual Chinese miner. They worked in groups, and so they could process the tailings in a much more systematic way. And it was often said that the Chinese were willing to work on worn-out claims that Anglos had given up. But, of course, the Chinese knew is with a certain application of effort and system, one could recover a great deal of gold from these tailings.
I see.
So I think that's one thing to think about as we sort of think about the Chinese.
And I'm not sure of this, but I believe gold has quite a high position in ancient Chinese culture as well. as a precious metal, of course, but also found in buildings and temples and in personal costume. So they were well aware of the potential of gold as a precious material in their own country, as well as a form of money over here.
Well, were there any other immigrant groups that came over in numbers that rival the Chinese, David?
Oh, most likely, but it's not something I've explored. I think the Irish, there wasn't quite an Irish contingent. There are early photographs of African Americans working the gold fields in a variety of ways. But again, it's pretty wide open. I don't think we can exclude any one group. German Jews came over in some quantity once they'd heard what was happening. In the Smithsonian collections, we have an important Torah cover from a German Jewish immigrant community that established themselves during the gold rush in Central California. So groups came over and bringing with them their traditions, their food ways, their costume, their religious traditions. And more or less, some stayed, some went back home, some had great success, some were persecuted. But again, it's part of that mix of that clash of cultures and that great intermixing that occurred around the gold.
I think as mining changes in the precious metal industries from this placer or surface mining to deep shaft mining, you get distinct immigrant groups. For example, in copper mining, you have the Cornish who come over because they have expertise in setting timbers and doing blasting in the shafts. And they're followed by the Irish, who sort of replace the Cornish working, and the Cornishmen move up into management. And any nation that's had a tradition of deep shaft industrial mining begins to travel to the United States. There's a great story about, this is later after gold, but industrial mining from Butte, Montana, where the seven stacks of the Never Sweat mine dominated the skyline, and immigrants would come into New York Harbor with simply a drawing of the seven stacks of the Never Sweat, and conductors would pass them on, and they would arrive safely out in the middle of nowhere in Butte, which I find incredible. And this allowed people to make it to Bisbee and other, or also into the Western coal mines, which are very important. But that gets away from our story a little bit.
Well, it's fine. It's fun to dabble in associating cultures with trade specialization. It did, in fact, occur in many fields of endeavor. Cultures, groups, individuals became known for their expertise in certain areas.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think it's probably time to address another notion and explore that, see if the popular imagination is accurate or not. Brianna from Georgia asks, how large were wagon parties as they made their way out west? Were these enormous trains, or did people tend to come out in smaller groups? Or how did this work? We'll start with David, I suppose.
Well, these are awfully good questions. They have a sort of a tinge of modern transportation to them, don't they? We think of highways crossing the country, big interstates with thousands of cars and buses and trucks. There was no such system in the 1840s, 1850s. We think of the 49ers as rugged miners, but they first had to be rugged travelers. How to get to California? Wagon train, certainly, but also by ship around down through the Caribbean to Panama, overland. However you can do it, perhaps on the back of a donkey, to another ship waiting to go up the coast of California. In terms of wagon trains, gosh, beats the heck out of me. Could have been 6 wagons, 20 wagons. Take your pick. I suspect they came in all shapes and sizes, however people could get themselves to California.
It also depended on which trail they were going on, because certain trails required strength in numbers, and other trails were fairly benign, and you could go with a fairly small group. I mean, one of the things we often forget is the fact that they couldn't have too large a group because they had to support the animals with them. And we have diary accounts where people who are late beginning their trek across the United States have trouble finding grazing because the grass on either side of the trail has been grazed off by the oxen and other animals that are being, the previous trains have taken with them. So you didn't want to, you didn't wish to have large amounts of animals to graze because that would take you farther away from the safety of the wagon train and make it much more difficult. I mean, it's one thing to walk 20 miles a day. It's another thing to walk 20 miles a day and then put in another 5 as you move your animals to good grass on either side of the trail.
That's right.
Right, keep in mind...
There's no way you could have gotten me to do that.
That's right, or any of us today. Keep in mind there were no developments along the way. There were no strip malls, no McDonald's, no gas stations, no nothing. These were people facing unending mountain ranges and the distant horizon for days and days and days. So they very much had to carry their provisions on their backs or in their wagons and depend on each other and, of course, on their animals for survival.
I think one of my students once, I think, did a interesting little study, and that is look through a diary to see what they were eating. So interested in food ways, and I think for a month they had biscuits for 2 meals a day for 3/4 of the days during that month. And can you imagine 5 months of that? 5 months of biscuits. By the time you got to California, you couldn't look at another biscuit.
Never want to see one again.
Yeah.
Where's the gold? Yes, get me out of here.
Right. No more biscuits. Just where's the gold? There was that wonderful Electronic Arts game where they, various conquerors would come and they'd ship would move up and they'd say, "Here we are. Where's the gold?"
That's it. Yes.
All right. Well, Josh from Georgia asks about Mormons and specifically. What motivated Mormon immigrants to come to California? Did they come, for example, for religious reasons, or did they come to make money and look for gold like everyone else did? Paula?
Initially, the Latter-day Saints came to found a theocracy, Deseret, the kingdom in the wilderness, and that was their first motivation, and I think we can understand that they having been burned out and persecuted in other areas. And at that point, they just figured that if they put enough territory between them and non-believers, they might have a chance to prosper. And, of course, they were correct. But they did a land office business in supplying any kind of traveler between the states and the coasts. Salt Lake City was the only thing there, for all intents and purposes. And so in terms of supplying the miners, supplying wagon trains, agricultural wagon trains headed to Oregon or Washington, they had made tons of money doing that. And even after the railroad arrived, they were very successful in doing the supply business.
It was breakaway groups of Mormons, I believe, that left Brigham Young and what we know today is Salt Lake City, and headed west themselves to go to the coast. And it's these Mormons, these saints, who end up forming their own mining enclaves and had a direct role in working with Marshall and Sutter in finding the first gold in Colma, California. There's some dispute over who found that first nugget, and some of the claims are of Mormons finding the first nuggets, not Marshall. So it goes back and forth, but they're certainly there at the outset, providing supporting roles, doing cooking and laundry and service work and provisioning, but also mining in their own right. However, it's separate sets of Mormons who chose not to stay behind in what is today Utah and headed for the coast instead.
I should also add, and here's just a little sidelight, and that is that Georgia contributed a good many miners. And the reason for that is that Georgia had one of the few gold mines in the eastern United States. And so there was a group of men who had some experience, a group of Georgians, who had some experience looking for gold. And in fact, Last Chance Gulch in Montana, the fourth largest gold strike, was discovered by four Georgians who had set out, who had not had good luck both in California and in Colorado, and coming north to Montana was, as one of them said, their last chance. And so the Georgians found. And so today, of course, we live in Montana with all kinds of restaurants named the Four Georgians.
Interesting. Fascinating. Yes. Don't forget Georgia.
Well, we have so many questions from Georgia, so I thought that there is a connection here.
That's yes, right. Georgia matters for sure.
Well, the next question comes from Steve in Louisiana, who wants to know about how chaotic life was in California. Some of us have a notion, perhaps, of sort of the beginnings of the lawless West, but Steve is wondering about how much order there really was in these mining communities. Were communities prepared for these numbers of people coming out west, and did they sort of cope with it that way, or how did law and order work? David?
Oh, well, my gosh, what law and order did work. There are obviously tales of people organizing themselves, as people tend to do, and getting a system of law and order set up some way, somehow. But it was very much a lawless land. Keep in mind that California was not even a state when the gold rush first began. Systems of governance and law and order were distant goals, if they were even goals at all. Housing arrangements, the claiming of one's stake, the protecting of that stake, the restitution that might occur if somebody broke into your claim, these were all subject to rough frontier justice in many cases. But there was also the U.S. Army out there in California that sought to impose a certain amount of order. But it was very much an experiment in how Americans could recreate the sense of order and justice that they had back east. There's no real good history I've seen of the gradual evolution of a legal system in the midst of the gold rush, but it's a fascinating story of jury rigging one's claim and then one's community fighting for what one possesses or what one wants to possess. Very much still the case that California remains this place of new laws, new senses of identity. We were reminded as new arrivals on the East Coast that when people say, well, why did you leave California? Why did you come back east? We really had nothing to say as a family other than just that it was just a little too wild for us out there in California. Somebody at some point tipped the United States and everything wasn't nailed down, fell into California. So many tales like that. Just, again, giving a Californian experience this aura of anything goes. All the laws are off the books, and you just make the best of it.
Paula, what is your sense about law and order there?
I think, you know, it's easy with our popular culture to sort of overstate.